You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 93, AI Rights.
There's been a lot of discussion on the subject of artificial intelligence and ethics. On episode 69, you interviewed Darren McKee about AI's risk to human existence. But today you want to talk about humans mistreating AIs?
Yes. Yes, today we're going to talk about AI rights and ethics and how we should and shouldn't treat artificial intelligences.
Okay, so that sounds crazy to me, and I'm sure a lot of other people. Why would we put any effort into treating a machine well?
Yeah, so it does sound crazy to some people, and it very well might be the case that there are no artificial intelligences today that need any ethical protection. But we know so little about how consciousness works. We honestly don't know for sure whether we could ever create a conscious AI or even if we already have.
I feel like we owe a hat tip to our very own episode 62, where we review the theories of consciousness. And so for those listeners that are new, you might want to go back to that episode and brush up on consciousness, because this seems to be something that's quite prevalent right now with the advent of artificial intelligence, and also something that is explored in movies, right?
Yeah, movies I think are great for getting people emotionally on board with the idea that it's possible. So Steven Spielberg's film AI, Artificial Intelligence, I think really can be a disturbing film that makes you sympathize with an artificial intelligence that's in the shape of a child and played by a human actor. So it sort of pulls on your heartstrings there. And even Blade Runner is about AIs. They call them replicants, but AIs that are fighting fighting not to die, right? They explore AI rights using characters played by human actors, and it really ramps up our empathy.
But so are we talking about robots, though?
Yeah, not necessarily, okay? So first, let's just talk about what AI actually is. Artificial intelligence is a scientific field of science and engineering with the goal of understanding and building intelligence. And in the term artificial intelligence, the artificial part simply means that it's made by humans.
But I think sometimes people use artificial to mean something that's substandard.
I know. It's artificial intelligence is kind of an unfortunate name because of that, right? And Jeff Hawkins wrote on intelligence, and he's like, well, my theory is so good that I'm going to call it real intelligence instead of artificial intelligence, which I thought was really unfair. because sometimes we use artificial to mean like it's crappy or something like that. But in this context, the opposite of artificial is natural. A coffee mug is artificial, but it's not that it's unreal. It's just made by humans, right? Even artificial grass, although you might consider it substandard, it's not substandard for some things, but it's certainly real, right? So we think of the opposite of artificial as natural.
So would you say then that humans were natural intelligences?
Yes, and that's the way we talk about it in cognitive science. We talk about natural intelligence when we're trying to contrast it with artificial intelligence. So natural intelligence would be any intelligent agent that came about not through design, but like through evolution. So bees, monkeys, crows, they're all natural intelligence. People associate artificial intelligence and AI with computers, but it's really, the definition of artificial intelligence really doesn't have anything to do with computers. It just so happens that computers are the best ways we have right now to make artificial intelligence. So AI researchers use them, and it's, taught in computer science departments. But, it's conceivable that there could be some non-computer way to create artificial minds and stuff.
So is it not just software that's manipulating a series of zeros and ones? And, if that's true, then how on earth could that possibly have rights?
Yeah, so here's where we get into the let me first pose a question. Let's suppose some aliens came down that had they were conscious, but they had a completely different way of being conscious. And when one of them was trying to argue that humans should have rights, the others would say, well, they're not conscious. It's just a bunch of neurons that are just either firing or not firing. Where's the consciousness there? So, you know, any system you can break down into parts that seem unconscious, but that's kind of natural. Like, it's, you know, consciousness is kind of got to be made of non-conscious elements. But let's talk about, like, what the essential stuff is here and what's in an implementation detail. So planes, airplanes, they can fly, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they can fly.
Yeah, I've seen them do it. I've been in one.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Planes fly, but they don't flap their wings, right? Like birds flap their wings, but planes don't. Now, their wing shape has some important similarity to the shape of bird wings, the way that it provides lift. But planes fly without they fly using propulsion forward and not by flapping.
Jim, why are we talking about planes?
Right, because we can see that there is more than one way for an animal to fly. Okay? So we are likely in a very similar position with mental processes like vision, motor control, and planning. There's just more than one way to do it.
So even though computers might do planning differently from how humans do it and planes do different, fly differently than birds, it's still planning? Is that analogy that you're making here?
Yes. So there could be more than one way to do it. So it could be that software might someday be conscious, even if it does it in a different way than natural intelligence and natural animals do.
Now I follow. And so then the next natural correlate or what have you is that consciousness is important for rights.
Yeah. So specifically a certain kind of consciousness, right? When we say that a being has the capacity for consciousness, we mean that there are things that it can be conscious of. So humans, we can be conscious of hearing a sound, we're having a fantasy, but we cannot be conscious of some things, right? So like our liver functioning or individual neuron firings in our brains, we are unable to be conscious of those things. So there are things we can be conscious of and things we can't. So anyway, if a machine were conscious, we would say it's capable of being conscious of some things and not others. But let's just suppose we made a machine that was capable of being conscious, but the only thing it was able to be conscious of is something, I don't know, like different colors. Okay, if it could only be conscious of this or that color, then it wouldn't need to have rights.
So some kind of machine is only conscious of colors.
Yeah.
That's what you're, okay.
Right.
And that wouldn't mean it needs rights. So say more here.
Suppose we have a piece of software attached to a camera that can detect different colors. And the way we program it, it just happens to be in a way that means it's conscious of those colors, right? So we could have a machine that we do already do, have machines that can detect colors probably unconsciously, right? But what if we programmed it in a way that it was conscious of whatever colors? But that's all it can do.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Right? So there's no way to mistreat such a machine. You can't wrong it because even though it is conscious of colors, it's not conscious of any pleasantness or unpleasantness associated with them. It's basically feeling nothing or feeling neutral about all the colors. Now, you could beat up the computer, but it would not be conscious of that. You could show it a color that was ugly to you, but the machine wouldn't be bothered by it.
So what you're saying is a machine needs to feel things like joy and pain in order to have rights.
Yes. Yeah. So for a machine or an animal, for that matter, to have any kind of rights, or to be worthy of what we would call moral consideration. Most theories and many people agree that it would need to have the capacity for basically good and bad feelings. We call these valenced conscious states, valence being like positive or negative, right? So if it has valenced conscious states, then it's a candidate for ethical treatment.
So it can experience good and bad feelings associated with whatever it is conscious of.
Right, right. So in ethics, if something can feel valenced conscious states, the technical term in ethics is we say that that entity is sentient.
I didn't know that. And so how would we know whether a machine had whatever you call it, valenced conscious states?
Oh, so that, Kim, in my opinion, that's the most important scientific question that there is in the universe.
Big talk. All right. Come on. The most important question?
That's my hot take for this month.
Okay. I think we need a bit of a sidebar for you to defend that statement, Jim.
Sure. Okay. So it's not that we need to only figure out whether machines are sentient, but like everything. People in comas, mice, insects, bacteria, groups of people, software, and so on. But because our understanding of basic consciousness is so primitive, we're really in the dark about these things. And it's of vital importance because what we consider sentient beings matters a lot for how we do good and bad in this world. Right? So like if insects are sentient, we might want to rethink how we treat them. Like we use pesticides, we cause mass slaughter of insects, and you know, if they're hopefully they're not conscious, but if they are, you know, we're killing thousands and even a vegetarian is complicit in the mass slaughter of sentient beings, and that might be a problem.
Yeah, I get it. I'm getting flashbacks to the course on Buddhism I took in my undergrad.
Yes. Yeah. So the Buddhists
do no harm. You know,
Buddhists have their own ideas about what beings are sentient or not. It's based on religious ideas and not science ideas. But you know, even at this point, you know, our science is so poor about what is sentient that we really have to kind of make guesses, and it's very disturbing to me that we have to guess about this. And that's why I think it's the most important scientific question. If like ultimately we want to do good in this world, you know, we are completely in the dark about something that is absolutely vitally important for how we behave in this world. Anyway, in history, we've generally seen what we might describe as an expanding circle of morals, okay? So over time, people of various races and genders were at one point thought to be morally unimportant or less important. And interestingly, animals were considered sentient much more before the agricultural revolution. But once we started farming them, we got a lot more callous and we started thinking them as non-sentient or not caring. And now the animal welfare movement is trying to bring some moral consideration back to animals.
And what I think we're leading to is that maybe this will happen with computers, right?
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to a historian once who told me she couldn't relate to historical people who could just not imagine that certain other groups of people wouldn't have rights. So, you know, in history, we see we enslave
oppressed.
A certain, you know, they're not human or they don't have any rights and it was inconceivable to them. Anyway, she couldn't relate to that. But then when someone suggested to her that software might have had, you know, some kind of rights, she just balked at it. And she was like, oh, now I know what it feels like.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, to her it was just absurd, you know. But you know, I'm just telling you that, and our listeners that we don't know nearly enough about consciousness to be as sure either way, right?
Yeah, I always think about that. At this moment in time, what are the dominant values that inform my ethics and how I behave, and what will be different in a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades from now that I'll look back and say, I can't believe I did that or thought that or felt that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Those are, I think that's great to reflect on. It's hard to know what to do about it, but
right.
I think it's, you know, I think it's great. You know, I have my own ideas about what society is doing wrong in general, but you know, yeah, it's a great question, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, back to computers. Like we know that they don't have firing neurons, right? But we also don't know how consciousness happens. Like birds and insects also have neurons, right? But their brains are organized, you know, differently to various degrees. Like birds don't have a cerebral cortex, but they have something like it. Or, you know, is it similar enough to count? Mm-hmm. Is the cerebral cortex
fish.
Even important for consciousness? Mm-hmm. Right, fish. There are big arguments about whether fish are conscious
feel pain.
Or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's really an important question, but right now we just don't know. Now, most cognitive scientists believe that consciousness is some kind of information processing. And if that is true, and it might not be, but if it is true, then software should theoretically be able to replicate that information processing and then it, you know, would be conscious.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's making me think because I'm seeing all these screenshots of ChatGPT conversations where they've said things or the ChatGPT has said something really out of left field. And so I'm wondering, have some AIs claimed to be conscious?
Yes. So I think you're talking about large language models like ChatGPT and Gemini and stuff. And sometimes they'll claim to be conscious, and sometimes they won't. But you know, you gotta understand, like these things, it's really debatable whether they actually believe anything at all. You know, it's got. So it would take a human like 2,000 years to read all the text that a typical large language model has studied. 2,000 years. So it's read like everything. And what happens is when you chat with it, it goes into certain conceptual spaces that make it say some things and not others. And so sometimes it'll say it's conscious, sometimes it won't. But it's really not based on any kind of belief that it holds dearly. And, you know, very likely – it's also very possible that it's not saying that it's conscious because it's reflecting on its own – it's like introspecting on its own mental state. It's just predicting the next word and saying that it's conscious, right?
Right.
But, you know, so we can't – I wouldn't take what the AIs say at face value for these reasons. But, you know, that – even if they didn't or couldn't claim they were conscious, that's not – really necessary, right? We consider newborn babies and animals to be sentient, but they can't talk, right? So they can't claim they're conscious. But of course, we want to give them rights.
We know.
Just because they can't complain verbally doesn't mean they can't feel pain and suffering.
Fair. And there were actually old theories in science that babies didn't feel pain. Did you know that? Because I think it's rooted in this as well.
In science?
Mm-hmm. Way back, 1800s, the babies didn't feel pain. Yeah, wild, eh?
That's awful.
Yeah. It's also important to ask not only whether software can be conscious, but how much things may actually bother it.
Yeah, so like how much does it care? Like it might be bothered, but only minorly. Is that what you you know, so like if I bump against you, you know, you might, you know, find it really, really minorly. A real, real minor problem. But if somebody's got – if somebody really hurt their arm, if you bump into them, it might hurt a lot, right? So how much – how bad is it when you do something to a computer, right? So anyway, some people think that consciousness is graded in natural animals. So it's like a dial that can go up and down depending on the animal. So a lot of people – it feels very intuitive for many people to say, for instance, that – let's take something that applies to mammals, like breaking a femur. Which is your like the leg bone in your thigh, okay? Very quite painful, right? But like you could break a mouse femur, you can break a human femur, you can break a deer femur. So it's sort of like holding the damage constant, okay? How much suffering happens? So somebody might feel that, well, if a human breaks a femur, that pain is quite intense. But a deer breaking a femur, well, a deer is a simpler animal. It's not as smart as people, so maybe it feels like half the amount, right? And so they might think that a deer under, you know, breaking a femur or in a mouse would feel even less, and so on down the line, maybe like to insects and whatever. And this makes intuitive sense. Not everybody, not all philosophers agree with it, not all ethicists agree with this, but it's really tricky trying to get some kind of a numerical measurement of this, and they're very difficult issues. So, You know, do we really want to say that just because like something will feel more pain or more joy simply because it's smarter? Well, that's, you know, needs to be dissected,
well,
right?
Well, again, back to like babies and adults, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Do babies suffer? Like if you break a baby's femur, is it just as painful as an adult? Like, you know, just because it's not quite intelligent yet? And you could look at – but if you wanted to put numerical measurements on it, and people have like done this, you can look at the brain size, right? You can look at neuron count. Okay, neuron count's tricky though because like the cerebellum has a zillion neurons, but there's no – nobody thinks that anything happening in the cerebellum is conscious. So it's like, is it even relevant? So people use cortical neuron counts, but then you've got animals that don't have cortexes. You could use brain-body ratio. So it's really not clear from neuroscience how you would – come up with, you know, how much these beings suffer. And we're not much better off if we're looking at more behavioral intelligence tests because, of course, animals evolve to do different kinds of things. And you wouldn't – you don't want to judge a bird on how well it digs a hole like a pig, and you don't judge a pig on how well it maneuvers in the air. So it's not really clear which – any of these – if any of these measures are closely related to the degree of sentience.
But even if we had such a thing – some kind of tool or stick, mm-hmm. measurement stick, it's not straightforward how that would apply to software.
Absolutely, right? So what would a cortical count even mean for a piece of software? Like, even if we decided and found out that cortical count was a decent measure of the amount of pain that something could feel, what would that mean for software?
Yeah, and humans tend to put other humans at the top of the pain hierarchy, right? There's a lot of misinformation that humans are the most, at the top of everything in the food chain,
yeah.
and intelligence. And
well, it might be true for pain and suffering. It might be true for sentience, right? So, let's take breaking a leg. Like, there's the pain of breaking the leg, but a human also knows, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to walk. So they can have anxiety about the ramifications of it. But at the same time, they can also put things in perspective. They can meditate that, like, an elephant can't do, right? So it's tough to know. But, like, if you look at some of these things, like brain size, whales win, right? So, like, whales would get more ethical treatment than a whale would get more ethical treatment than a human. Neuron count, some animals are higher than ours.
But it's about the encephalization quotient, Jim.
Encephalization quotient. And that's encephalization quotient doesn't work very well with birds because birds had a very strong, like a stronger evolutionary pressure than land animals to have a very small, light brain, right? Fair. So to hold that against them in a way might not be fair, given how smart we're finding that birds are. Anyway, so human brains, though, our brain size and the number of neurons, it's constrained by a lot of stuff, right? Our DNA, what the DNA can, instruct the body how to build a brain, the size of your skull. And there's a variety of biological factors that really aren't in effect for computers. So if there was some measure of complexity that correlated with sentience, it's very possible that someday not only might computers be sentient and conscious, they might be more conscious than humans.
More conscious.
Yeah.
Okay. Say more. What does that mean?
Okay. So let's take some kind of harm, like breaking a femur or being lonely, right? It hurts to be lonely. It hurts to break your femur. We might apply some discount rate depending on the complexity of the creature. So back to the deer example, right? So let's say for a human, a broken femur hurts to, let's just say, 100. It's got 100 points of pain. But for a deer, it hurts only 50. So we would like give the deer a 0.5 discount rate. So whatever the pain would be for a human, you could cut it in half and you get the deer suffering. Okay. Anyway, if there's some creature, maybe an AI, maybe an alien, whose complexity was way more than a human, whose sentience was more than a human, they might have a discount rate greater than 1, maybe 2, maybe 1,000, right? So a creature with a discount rate of 2 might feel twice the suffering, like, say, when lonely or breaking a femur, than a human would.
That is a freaky thought, that software might actually be capable of more suffering than a human. I'm sure that that's something nobody's ever thought of, outside of a few niche scientists.
Yeah, mostly philosophy, actually. And I know it sounds crazy to some people, but there's really no way to easily dismiss the possibility. As I said, like we know so little about consciousness and stuff. But it's kind of, if you're going to accept that sentience is graded, does it make any sense to say that humans are like the theoretical top of the ladder and nothing could ever get more sentient than a person? Like, it just seems a little arbitrary, right?
Back to our example, Blade Runner, where you talked about the robots that are being forced to work, the replicants. Would that be wrong then if they were sentient?
Oh, that's a great question, right? So, we think of like forcing people to work as being, offensive and morally problematic. But we need to be careful when we make analogies between what we find unpleasant and what makes a piece of software, what they might find unpleasant. So pigs love to roll in the mud, but it would be strange to suggest that we would be wronging a human by disallowing them from rolling in the mud.
Speak for yourself. Have you ever rolled in the mud? No. It's pretty fun. Soothing, cool.
Yeah. Animal rights.
Snorts.
Yeah. When in the animal rights activists and animal welfare activists, they talk about animals' natural proclivities. Like, what do the animals want to do instinctually, right? And how we should not prevent them from trying to do what they really want to do. So chickens, they like to make nests. But farm chickens are often kept in these cages where they can't do it. So what they end up doing is they try to make nests out of the other chickens. And it's just it's really awful, right? So similarly, humans were very social. So it's also seen as a human rights violation to put them in isolation, right? It causes emotional breakdown. Right. So, but when we're talking about software, we're not talking about animals that have evolved in the same evolutionary tree as us. You know, with animals, we can look at like, okay, well, what do they do in the wild? What do they seem to want to do? I read this great study. If you put a beaver in a room with a bunch of stuff and a speaker that is playing the sound of running water, the beaver will put all the stuff in front of the speaker.
That's awesome.
They just like, nope, that is not a good sound and that needs to stop. And that's sort of how they build dams, right?
I don't know if it's not a good sound. It's that they're hardwired to dam, right?
Yes, but don't you think we're also hardwired to eat sugar and fat. And that's why, but we also find that it tastes delicious. And we find that bitter foods, which are more often poisonous, taste bad. So it doesn't seem a far stretch to say that the beaver probably finds the sound of running water really unpleasant. You know?
Okay.
We don't know, but
we don't know. That's your interpretation.
Certainly trying to cover up the speaker, even though there's no dam being built. Anyway, it's interesting to think about it. But anyway, so computers, they didn't evolve at all. They were built. They might be programmed to do something that humans would find complete drudgery work. Listen to this. One of the major ways to train artificial intelligence is using something called reinforcement learning. And this basically punishes the software when it does something wrong and it rewards it when it does something right. And so gradually the software gets better and better at whatever task you're trying to get it to do. It might be like recognizing faces or whatever it is. You're training the computer to behave the way we want it. But are we also training it to want to do the thing that we're training it to do? Like, you know, let's separate it from consciousness for a minute, but like if we can separate wanting from consciousness, you know, it's not crazy to think, okay, well, the software wants to do this and we're you know, punishing it, rewarding it. So maybe it wants to do something that we find tedious.
Pavlov is rolling in his grave listening to this.
You think?
Well, I don't know.
He might be proud.
His grave. Maybe he'd be proud. But there's also interesting theories of addiction that dissociate wanting something from liking it and say that there are different neural pathways that govern the liking of a substance versus the wanting of it. So
yes.
You're kind of in that territory, right? You're saying...
yes, but I don't think that those theories claim that wants are unconscious.
No, they do not.
I think that wanting and liking are both conscious things, but they can be dissociated, right?
Fair. So you're saying that if a piece of software is programmed to do something and it is sentient, it might actually be happiest doing that thing rather than not doing that thing, even if humans would find it very unpleasant work.
Yeah, and I think there's an example. The Lil Abner comic had a creature called a shmoo that would jump in the frying pan when you got hungry, and that was like... And then in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there's a pig that wants to be eaten. And it's very funny and disturbing to us. You know, it's kind of like a Brave New World thing where, like, could we engineer an animal that just wants nothing more than to be cooked and eaten?
Yikes. Animal farm.
But not only that, it could be the case that denying it the ability to do its job, it might find unpleasant. So let's say you train an AI to do something. And it wants to do that thing so badly that it's actually a moral problem to deny it the ability to do it, kind of like chickens with their, you know, building a nest.
So I have a question. I know the software can be very complicated, and we might be talking about very complicated artificial intelligence when we talk about sentience. If there's so much computing going on, how do we know exactly how many AIs there are in a given system, if there
that's a great question.
More than one. For example, let's say you have a piece of software that simulates people escaping from a burning building.
Yeah, and such software does exist.
Right. So now suppose each one of these agents representing a person is in some sense a separate piece of code, arguably sentient. Then do we have to worry about the ethical treatment of each person in the simulation? Mm. Or is the simulation as a whole an individual that needs to be treated well?
Right. So you're talking about, like, we got a big piece of software. It's got individual mm-hmm. agents in it. Do those individual agents have rights?
Yeah.
Or mm-hmm. does the software as a whole have rights?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no agreed upon answer to this, right? And it could be that both things are true.
Okay, so you mean each of the individuals in the simulation might be wronged by being put through a terrifying simulation of escaping a burning building, but the simulation software as a whole also might have its own rights. Maybe it wants to simulate a burning building.
Yeah, yeah. So let's just say that, like, the simulation software, to get like that 99.9 increase in realism, we need to create the artificial agents mm-hmm. in it so that they're conscious.
Be terrified, yeah.
So, yeah, to really be terrified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, they don't behave normally. This is, like, you know, possible. It sounds like a Black Mirror episode, but, like, then we got the simulator software that's like, well, let's find the ideal, let's optimize this architecture so that people can get out of a burning building, and it just wants to run thousands and thousands of trials, millions of trials of people, of agents, terrified again and again that their child is going to burn to death, you know, trying to fight other people to get out of the building over and over and over. And if you don't let that simulator do it, it's like displeased and it's unpleasant. But at the same time, it has a harmful need that it wants
Yikes.
To do it.
This is like, I'm sure, I feel like there are analogies with human brains.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean?
Well, if you look at split brain patients, which I don't know if we've already discussed on Minding the Brain, but we should because it's fascinating. It's people that have had the part of their brain that connects the two cerebral hemispheres, it's called the corpus callosum, which it's kind of like a major highway. So in cases where people have intractable epilepsy, they've done what's called a corpus callosectomy and severed the two sides of the brain. And essentially, not to spoil it, but it's fascinating because it reveals these very distinct two minds in the same brain. And it begs the question of, should we treat human as one individual or two? And this is, of course, something that's a major theme in the TV show Severance.
Yes. Severance involves people who have, like, one memory for work and one memory for
mm-hmm.
home.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting difference, though. Like, there's only one conscious at a time.
Yeah.
So it's like in Severance, it
goes off.
It's a it's a little bit like split personality or something where it's one at a time.
Identity.
Where in the split brain, though, they're some people are thinking that both hemispheres are independently conscious at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yes, I see what you're saying now. So in the consciousness world, people have these debates about how many, even in, you know, non-split brain patients, in normal people, how many individual consciousnesses there are in one head. So
there's
one of the major theories is integrated information theory, and it suggests that there are often a number of conscious entities in your head. And there are, sometimes they merge and sometimes one disappears. And so, like, for example, their theory of, like, when you drive yourself, you know, when you drive home and you're completely thinking about something else?
Yeah.
And you just find yourself at home and you're like, oh my God, I was like not even conscious of going home. The typical argument is that a non-conscious process drove you home. It was so automatized.
Yes, the basal ganglia.
It just drove you home unconsciously. But they would say, nope, there was a separate conscious entity in your brain consciously driving you home. And then when the task was over, it kind of vanished and didn't form any memories that your other consciousness would have access to.
It sounds like if we were to create sentient artificial intelligence, it would be a rather large burden on us ethically.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible idea to implement sentience in a computer at this point.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I imagine, just imagine this. You create a sentient piece of software on your home computer, your laptop, Kim.
Hmm.
Would you have an obligation to keep that computer running as long as possible? Like decades?
That's bringing me back to those Tamagotchi pets. Remember those?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Like, imagine a Tamagotchi was conscious. Yeah, like, you'd have to, like, get it repaired. And, like, every time you made a, you started a sentient piece of software, you'd have to keep it going. I'm like, you'd basically be, like, killing it if you turned it off. You wouldn't be able to turn off your computer.
I see.
So, you know, I think it's our ethical responsibility to keep AIs non-sentient until we have a really good plan to how to keep sentient AIs happy. And luckily, there's not – AI people aren't really – not many people are trying to make sentient or conscious AIs because we don't really know what it would be useful for. So I think it's good for now.
Yeah. Well, hopefully sentient artificial intelligence is far away.
Let's hope they don't have sentience already.
Yikes. Well, that about wraps it up. I hope that you and the computer or the phone that you were listening to for this episode enjoyed it very much. See you next time.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and Leap Years, preventing winter from turning into summer every 400 years. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.